without there having to be another substantiated abuse or neglect.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't want you to think that every child who reentered was abused again,
yeah.
But sometimes during the period when we are watching the family to see how the reunification's going, there might be something that triggers alarm enough to make a removal of the child.
Yeah.
That also might be the way that you get accurate statistics that even show that there is this percentage that is higher than what we would want, because if you weren't doing the follow-up, you may not even know that it's happening.
Correct.
I have a question about how Idaho and Washington are substantially higher than Oregon's, and I'm wondering if you could give us your ideas. Have you looked at what Idaho and Washington are doing? We have Idaho at 88.9%, Washington at 83%, and Oregon at 66.8%. So I'm just wondering what they may be doing differently, if you can identify that.
Yeah. Chair Richardson, I do not actually know what they're doing differently at this point in time. That is 30.
I understand it could be reporting, it could be right. Different criteria. I mean, it's not always the same, but when you see that kind of a difference, then it certainly would be worth looking into.
Correct. Certainly one of the unique things around Oregon is actually the level of supervision that is provided and the custody of the children with the department. So oftentimes when children are returned home, the court will maintain custody of that child to the department for level of supervision. Other parts of this country will have situations where once a child goes home, the court removes the custody of that child to the department. And so once that custody is ended, then that level of supervision is on a voluntary basis. And so we end up having, to some degree, a longer period of supervision of that child, and then your 12 months adds on after that. So really you're looking at, if the child physically goes home to mother today, by most of the practices in Oregon, we're almost talking about an 18-month period of time, whereas in other states it may actually be a very shorter amount of time once the custody is eliminated for the child going back home.
I would think that, you know, I know the commitment of you and your staff, and I would think that there's probably somebody in your staff who's really interested in what's going on elsewhere and might have that information, and we would appreciate having, you know, a paragraph on each of these states indicating what the analysis is, you know, why you think that their numbers are better, and is there something that we could do to to utilize their model if there's some success there, or maybe it's just an issue of, you know, that it's apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm.
Could we get that kind of information from you?
Certainly, Chair Richards, and we'll provide that for you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Thank you. Along the same line of reasoning and questioning, do you know of any other source for information and numbers other than your agency for the state of Oregon, Northwest Labs in Seattle, or any place else that keeps any kind of statistics on these on this kind of information?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, yes, there's actually a number of foundations and organizations that we actually work with or access information. Child Welfare League of America is one of the most prominent ones around the country, and they track a lot of data. They have a data system we can actually tap into to look at comparisons of other states, and that's where some of these similarities are going to start coming from as well. The Children and Family Services Bureau for the federal government actually is able to track a lot of data. Again, states all provide data, statistical information to the feds, and then we're able to extract much of that. We've also been working with the Annie E. Casey Foundation over the last several years of looking at self-evaluation within the department and very clearly looking in some of our branches to say, it's one thing to say your number's 12 or 15 or 75, well, what the heck does that mean? And so that's some of the self-evaluation piece that we've been doing. I think last session we actually had representatives from the Annie Casey come and present to a committee around really what is self-evaluation and how can it actually help inform the department on making decisions. And that's where we're heading in a lot of these directions.
I'd like to see some of that data. We'll try to gather it to my office and bring it back to committee if we can.
That'd be great. Thank you.
We're pretty swamped, but we'll do the best we can.
Are there other models for delivering foster care that involve private organizations? I mean, are there other states that are doing that? Are we doing any of that in Oregon? Where do we stand in that regard?
Chair Richardson, yes, we actually do some of that in Oregon, and it is done around the country as well. We actually have a couple of different private organizations that actually provide foster care. Some of the larger ones you might hear of are the Albertina Kerr Center, Boys and Girls Aid Society, Morrison Center for Children and Families. They provide foster care for children as well, and we contract with them to provide a higher level of care for some of our children.
Are there actual facilities then where children are, or organizations that coordinate, that go out and find foster homes and help make placements?
Right. It's actually a combination. Part of what they provide is a level of treatment that may actually be a facility, but they also provide therapeutic foster care, which is going to be in the community with mother and father. You know, it's the family foster care model, but they may actually provide a higher level of supervision or clinical assessments for those children. And so there are private organizations that do this around the state. KC Family Program has been one that we have historically worked with over the last 30 years. They have now moved out of Oregon and early in Seattle area and other parts of the country. But Volunteers America in Portland is also starting to do some foster care, and we contract with them to serve some children in foster care settings as well.
Okay, thank you.
I would then draw your attention to, I'm going to take you through another flip, go through the appendices. That'll be the next section that I want to draw your attention to in a few areas. And under the appendices, I would draw your attention to page 9 to begin with. And the next couple of pages are a number of charts that are oftentimes the frequently asked questions, and I think that some of them have already come up here. Questions around where do these children go when they leave out-of-home care placement. And as you can see on that pie chart there, 62.5% of these children actually return home. Another 20.4% of the children are adopted. And then you can see the breakdown from there. The next couple of pages, and I won't walk you through all those because I understand very aware of the time crunch today with the agenda you've got.
Mr.
But there
Chair.
Senator.
Just a question regarding the adoption. You have 20.4%. What's the average age of those who are adopted?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chair Richardson, Senator Moyna Sanderson, the average age, I don't really have off the top of my head. I probably should have that.
Is it young?
Kathy Ledesma will be up next as soon as I'm done talking about the adoption program, and she'll have all that information.
Thanks.
So on page 10, I would direct you to just a few graphs that might show you more about exactly populations that we're serving. The children entering care chart really breaks it out by age groups, and so that starts addressing some of that question about how old are these children in our system. Page 11, and again, I'm going through these fast. I understand you've read through them, but also page 11 actually talks about the primary reason children enter care. And to some degree, that starts peeling away a little bit of the question that Representative Hansen had yesterday around, can you sort out the difference between the drug abuse and the alcohol abuse? And in many ways, this doesn't quite do that, but at least talks about, of those children that are coming in, which were the primary indicators that we identified were the factors of these children. And so somebody may, quite honestly, have a drug abuse problem. They may also have an alcohol abuse problem, and they may also have been physically abusing these children. And so oftentimes when you're dealing with substance abuse, it's polysubstance abuse, and we'll hear that later in the department's presentations around addiction services. But that starts at least kind of touch that a little bit. The chart on page 12 gives you really a pretty high-level view of the cost of caring for children. Again, when the family foster care rates, those are the basic rates that we are providing for families caring for children, and that is the rate where they are...
May I interrupt just for a moment?
Certainly.
I'm still on page 11.
Okay.
And when I see parent drug abuse at 71% and parental alcohol abuse at 68%, is that saying that there are some of these families that are there's drugs and alcohol, or that alcohol is 68, you know, there's only 3% difference?
Chair Richardson, no, it actually is that they have both. So these are the children that are coming in. 71% of the children coming in have had parents with some drug abuse issue, which is part of the reason why they're coming in.
So that if there's 71% that have drug abuse and 68% with alcohol, that means that there's only 3% of that population that are drugs without alcohol.
Not necessarily.
Yeah, not necessarily. In terms of, it may be that those are really raw numbers. They're not really compared right to one to the next. If 68% of them are for an alcohol abuse, it may be that was the only issue for that family. Another one may have multiple issues within that family. So you, they're not quite the comparison, direct correlation to them.
Okay, I see.
So the cost of caring for children, again, you can see how it, we've broken it out for the age groups and what it's actually to cover the cost. Those, again, as we, I started yesterday talking about our foster families around the state, really when you break that down into $378 a month or $485, that gets down to caring for these children is $12 to $16 a day. That's paying for, you know, the $6 for the field trip on Friday to the movies. That's paying for soccer fees. That's really paying for a lot of that kind of stuff that kids get in the community and they should be getting in their families. So when you hear the statement out there, which is can be common out there, that foster parents are only in this for the money, that's mm-hmm. the money that the majority of these families are getting.
What about families that have four or more foster children?
Yeah, the rates that we've showed you there are the basic rates. So if a child is coming in for basic foster care, that's the rate they are provided per day, irregardless if they have one child or, well, excuse me, per child. So it may be $12 for this child, $12 for another child, $16 for the other child. If the children have a special need, so a high level of care, then we actually may be providing additional resources into that family to provide extra supervision or nursing assistance in the home or other mentoring services.
It would seem to me that in foster homes where you have older children that are not siblings, that there would be a much greater likelihood of sexual abuse or abuse among the foster children than in other foster home situations. Is there any breakdown in that? Has that been looked at?
Chair Richardson, I don't have the breakdown for you on that. It certainly goes back into our questions around the abuse in foster care and looking at what are those configurations. Very often, the foster parents that are caring for the children are going to be caring for groups of children within age groups. And so we have many foster parents that will come in and say, I want to foster children, but I only want to foster kids under age five, or I only want to foster, you know, the elementary school kids. And so we do have homes that might have a teenager and little kids, but more predominantly it's going to be a family who's caring for kids right around the same age group. And so you're not going to get that mix as much as one might think.
Because I would think that that would be something you'd be looking very closely at because of the concern of mm-hmm. of abuse in foster home situation, because we hear about those cases,
right.
And if there is a marked increase of those instances where you have multiple or non-sibling close relationship in ages of multiple children in a foster home, that that would indicate something that would be identified and would be dealt with.
Right.
Chair Richardson, that is part of the matching process that we talked about yesterday, that if you have a child who needs foster care placement, and if that child is a vulnerable age, and if there's someone in that home already that would present a danger to the child, then you wouldn't place in that home. One of the dilemmas in foster care now is that a lot of children come in, and as they enter for the first time, there's very little history on those children known to the department. So as Kevin said, we try to be careful in terms of not mixing age groups of children so that we would make children susceptible by putting them in a foster home. It's also one of the things foster parents are trained on in terms of how to protect the children within the family. And if they notice behaviors that we were not aware of, that's part of the ongoing dialogue with the foster family.
Okay, thank you.
I would then have you just turn to the chart there on page 13 is probably not the the clearest chart. It really is trying to give you a synopsis of saying that these families are across the state and they're in all of our communities. And I think that's really a testament to the families of Oregon, that it doesn't really matter what city you're living in, that people are standing up in the communities to care for these kids. And so they are staying within the communities. The last chart then for my area is on page 14, and that gives you a breakdown. What I spoke to real briefly was around the question oftentimes is, how many relatives do we have these children with? And that shows you the breakdown of, right now we're tracking at about 30% of our children in care are actually placed with their relatives. Relatives also are required to go through the same level of background checks and training as other foster families are. So that's the comparison there. And then, Chair Richardson, you'd ask the question around looking at the average number of families over the course of a five-year period. and that's it at a high level. It doesn't break it down by county. We can certainly break it down by county, but that's really what we're looking at. And so you'll see that there is a increase. The only one that I really draw your attention to is that we had a significant increase in the year 2000, and that was merely from the fact that we instituted rules at that time to start requiring all relatives to be certified. So once they all had to start getting a license, that's where that number jumped up at that point. But otherwise, it's really been looking at tracking fairly stable over the number of years, and yet you recall when we started, the number of kids coming into care have not tracked very stable the last couple of years. So that is all I have to provide for you as far as out-of-home care section. If there's any other questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Any members, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry we missed half an hour of yesterday's presentation. This is really key to what your agency does, and frankly, I think it's the key to DHS, because I think we for the most part, deal with the same families generation after generation after generation in the state, and this is where we can have an opportunity to stop that generational movement. You have 4,000 or 5,000 children in foster care at any one given time in the state. Is that correct?
Chair Richards and Senator Bates, no. Those are the number of kids that came in this last year. What we actually have were more around 7,400 children.
As you rotate those kids through, how many? I'm not sure I asked this question properly. You have kids going in and out of foster care all the time. You know the length of stay on the average for those. How many people are actually in a given 5-year period of time, for instance, or some lock of time, would you estimate, how many kids, separate different kids, go through the foster care programs? I mean, are we looking at the same children going through for the most part, completely different children for the most part?
Right.
Yeah. Give me some idea of what we're really looking at.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, what we're looking at is in 1 year, we're looking at 13,000 different unique children that have experienced foster care in one period of time. The next year, then, did some of those same children experience it at that point in time? Yes, there would be some of those duplicate numbers, but for the most part, it is 13 unique ones every year that are experiencing foster care system.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, one caveat on that. Now, some of those 13,000, of course, will not leave care. And so the ones that stay in care are duplicate counts the next year for the 13,000 the next year. So we have in the neighborhood of 4,000 to 5,000 each year of children who enter and children who exit. And so then you have a stable population, and as we transition into talking about adoption, that, of course, will pick up some of that census of children who have been in the system for several years.
Thank you.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you about foster care.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma, and I am here this morning from DHS to talk to you about our adoption services. I'll refer you to start with to behind the Children, Adults, and Families yellow tab, back to the blue tab, page 17. And a little later we'll be talking about key performance measure on page 11 behind that white tab, and then I'll go to the appendix and I'll direct you there when we get there. I'd like to start this morning by answering Senator Moniz Anderson's question about the age of children, because it really gives us a wonderful place to start. Often when people think of the word adoption, they immediately go to healthy white newborn baby, and that is not the children we're talking about when we talk about foster care adoption or special needs adoption. So, Senator, you specifically asked the question about the age of children going on to adoption. For the last 2 years, about 20% of our children were under the age of 3 at the time of adoption. A quarter of the children were between 3 and 4. Fully a third of the children were between 5 and 8. And then 10% were 9 and 10-year-olds. 10% were 11 to 13. And about 4% of the children were 14 and older. Some of those 14-year-olds were children who had been in care for a substantial length of time. However, some of them were children who had been in care for 2 or 3 years or even less than that, who came into care as teenagers or as young older children and went on to adoption, did not return home.
Just to follow up on that question, do a number of the foster care parents end up adopting, or is this out of the, they've been in the foster care system and then adopted?
Chair Richardson, Senator Anderson, about one-third of the children who are adopted by their foster parents. That's not exactly answering your question. What you're asking is what percentage of foster parents adopt, and often we confuse those two numbers, but a third of the children who are adopted by their non-related foster parents.
Did you say 14% are 14 and older?
No. Chair Richardson, 4% are 14 and older. And those are real round numbers. Does that add up to some proximity of 100%?
That's close.
I hope. Thank you. So starting on page 17, the DHS adoption program, when I talk about adoption services, includes all of those services to terminate either voluntarily or involuntary a parent's rights to their children. We take this activity very seriously, probably second to the death penalty. It's the most serious invasion that the government makes into the lives of its citizens, is to terminate those parental rights. So when parents are unable to provide for the safety, permanency, and well-being needs of their children on a long-term permanent basis, that's what we do. And then we establish a new relationship with an adoptive family, and we provide support services for those families, both financially and with other services after those adoptions are established. We operate the Oregon Voluntary Adoption Registry, which is the repository of all of the information regarding all adoptions that occur in Oregon, and that's about 120,000 adoptions have occurred in Oregon. That's of all types since 1910 when we began maintaining that registry. The number of children receiving adoption assistance benefits that is sometimes called adoption subsidy has grown absolutely dramatically since 1995, nearly tripling since 1995. And we'll look more specifically at those numbers in a few minutes. Could we have the first slide? When we look at the children that are served or who our clients are, this is a chart since 1998 of the children who have been freed for adoption and the children who end up being adopted. As you can see, when in 1998-99, we were in what we would consider a deficit position. More children were being freed than were being adopted. Since then, we've reversed that trend, and now for the last year, the last 2 years, we have more children actually getting to adoption than we are freeing. Right now, currently, looking over the last several months, we are freeing about 75 children per month and finalizing adoptions of about 75 children per month.
Okay, so annually we're talking about 900?
Chair Richardson, that's an approximate number, about 900 a year. This last year our finalizations were 943, and the children that we freed were a hair under 900.
And the budget for this program is $115 million a biennium?
I would defer to our budget folks on that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, the budget for this adoptions budget structure is $115 million total fund in the governor's budget for 2005-07. And about half of that, $56 million, is general fund.
Thank you.
Historically, where I started out in responding to Senator Moniz Anderson's question. We began adoption services over 50 years ago in the Department of Human Services. The first major reform that impacted adoption was in 1980. That was the passage of the federal public law 96272 that created citizen review boards. In addition to that, it created the Adoption Assistance Program. That was to respond to the national problem, the growing problem of more children in foster care. It was intended to remove financial barriers to the adoption of children from foster care by providing ongoing subsidies to families who adopt children from our care. This was because the children were no longer healthy, white, newborn infants. Rather, many of them were drug affected, beginning in the 70s and 80s. They were older children, children who had serious handicapping conditions, mental, emotional, physical conditions, either as a result of the abuse or that's how they were when we discovered them. Fast forward about 17 years.
Okay, wait. Let's not leave there.
Okay.
If we've tripled the expenditures, the adoption subsidies since 95, is that because the types of children being adopted have changed so dramatically in the last 9 years, or there's been a change in our philosophy about providing subsidies after an adoption takes place, or is there some other reason that I haven't thought of?
Representative Richardson, that's a very good question. The primary driver of the cost of adoption assistance is purely the number of children who receive that benefit.
Well, I understand, but there's a decision to grant that benefit to families after they brought a child in as their own child. And I realize I adopted a 10-year-old, so, I mean, I've been through this myself. And so I'm wondering, I guess what I'm getting to is the justification for paying families subsidies after they've made the decision to adopt a child and make it part of their family. And I understand that there would be certain circumstances where, because of the costs, that decision would be made. But what I have seen is that it is a very broad practice to give monthly subsidies to families after they've adopted a child, and that practice wasn't in place before 95 to the extent that it is now.
Chair Richardson, the practice in Oregon and across the country really has been in place since 1980 with the establishment of the federal adoption subsidy and the rules in the social the Federal Social Security Act. The federal rules define and our state rules as well as our statute define what qualifies a child for adoption assistance, and it's the child's qualification, not the family's qualification. The child needs to be older, meaning over the age of seven or older if it's a single child. If it's a member of a sibling group, then that age factor changes. But being part of a sibling group that needs placement together constitutes a special need. A child of color or a child with one or more physical, emotional, or mental conditions that require specialized care.
I don't want to drill down too much on this, so I'll just ask one final question. I'm not clear why that would focus on the child condition in one of those categories and not on a means test of the families, because if the family can afford to raise another child and there's not, I mean, the fact that one is of color does not mean that there's going to be substantial additional costs. Why would we be using money to subsidize that situation? Can you help me understand?
Chair Richardson, I wish I could help you to understand that. That is how the Social Security Act is written. It's an entitlement program, and it is based on the needs of the child.
Okay, and I said Social Security, so this is only federal funds that are going to these subsidies?
The purpose of that federal law
Chair Richardson, was that the way Congress looked at that at the time was the children were already in foster care. So the state is already making a payment for those children. And so the determination was made that just because someone decided, and this actually grew out of a lot of advocacy around children in limbo in foster care, they weren't moving to adoption. And foster parents said, we would be willing to adopt children who are living with us especially, but we can't afford to do that. We are barely making it on the budget we have with what we get from the state. So the thinking behind it was it is actually less expensive for the state and the federal government because the case actually gets closed when the adoption is finalized. So while that money payment would follow the child from foster care over into adoption, their cost savings is that you no longer have an open or an active case. And remember that while she said, Kathy said that 30% of the adoptions are foster families where the children are, about another 30% are also relatives who can't afford to adopt but are willing to provide foster care, and then you move the payment to follow the child if the child is a special needs child, and each state defines special needs a little bit differently across the country. That's the flexibility the state has.
Okay. I would like to, if you would, provide for us a detailed set of information. I'd like to know the amount of money that is spent on these subsidies. I'd like to know the number of, you've said 20%, 30% of the adoptions are going, are being, no, that foster care is 30%. What is the number of families that are adopting? What percent?
Chair Richardson, another 30% usually are relatives who are adopting children they're providing care for.
All right, so we have state funds being expended to pay relatives after they have adopted their own family members, and I understand that that's a decision that's made. But I'd like to know what is that, what is the cost? I'd like to have a full breakdown on that. I'd like to see what the changes in cost over the last, since 95, and give me as much detail as you can, or give us as much detail as you can on where, what the needs are of those families. I'd like to know how many are severe needs, you know, if they're drug babies or quadriplegic, or, you know, I mean, certainly those instances are different than a classification that has no relationship to dollar needs.
Right.
So could you provide that for us?
Yes, we can. And Chair Richardson, the other point that you made is while Oregon has had some form of subsidy since 1980, what really has accelerated the need to move children, of course, is the Adoption and Safe Families Act. The intent of that act now has time frames on how long children can remain in foster care. And if you are not able to send a child safely back home, the law no longer allows you to just continue the child in foster care. And so there have been tests about whether or not a state could deny the adoption benefits, and we can get you that information too. But the idea still is that the child then ends up with permanency. And I understand, and I think it really does deserve some public discussion, because I think most people don't understand what some of the drivers are behind that growth in the adoption subsidy program.
I certainly can understand that federal requirements require this to take place, and so what? But the idea that we're mainly closing out a file and changing a designation from foster child to adopted child, but the subsidies continue, is a blend between what was originally the idea that we're going to provide temporary assistance to a child until they have a new family, and now we've government institutionalized the whole process. And so I don't know at what cost that is and just how it breaks down.
We can get that information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make summation this that I think is correct, and you're going to correct me if I'm wrong, okay? My memory of this is that we actually have seen a sea change since 1995 as far as how we handle children who are no longer with their original families. We used to have a system that really supported the foster program, and these kids, especially the older kids, kids over 5 or 6 years of age, would spend their entire life until adulthood in various foster homes, often as many as 10 or 15 homes, or 5 or 6 homes, depending on their special problems, most of which were emotional. And this was something we just couldn't seem to break out of, because these were kids who were difficult to adopt, very difficult to adopt, with a lot of emotional and physical problems, usually emotional, my memory is. So the effort was to put them into a home where they have some permanency, to have some possibility of working on their emotional problems and other issues they might have. To do that, we shifted from foster settings to adoptive settings with support in adoptive settings. And that's the big change we've seen. So when you bring these figures forward, which should be interesting, we need not only see how much we're putting into adoptive families to take care of kids who are older, you know, not the one-year-old and two-year-olds, but the more difficult placements we're making, and we'll continue to make it, because we know kids will come into the foster program, not as infants all the time, but as older kids. See the changes incurred also on the foster side. What would be the cost if those children had stayed in the foster program? What would it cost them, not only the state in front of you financially, but that was not a good place for those kids to be? And it's a new program of putting them into adoption and supporting those adoptive families with these difficult children is a better of the two programs. I think that was the thrust of that program in 95 in broad terms. Please correct me if I've missed the boat here.
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, no, you're absolutely correct. That is, and what we can do with that little historical chronology of this issue is to show perhaps what would have been the cost had the children remained in the foster care system. Because, again, remember that the standard was for these children to be adopted, their rights, their parents' rights had to be terminated. So these are pretty significant cases in terms of children not being able to return home because it had to meet the standard of law to terminate those parental rights in order to free the child for adoption. But we will calculate that as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I assume that for those children that are adopted because of the loss of their parents, the adoptive parents would have continued to receive SSI benefits because of the deceased parent.
Representative Richardson, Chair Richardson, yes, adoption assistance is the support of last resort. We look to all other income that's available to the child and use that in the calculation of the amount of support of adoption assistance that is available to the child. If SSI is available, that's used first. Chair Richardson, I'm sorry.
Is there any other questions? I just want to make sure.
Okay.
Representative Hannah.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you may have asked this, but I want to make sure that we understand it as we get further into the budget process. And that was, of the $115 million, will we see a breakdown of what specifically, what were the payments for subsidy and that part, which is management of the program? Will we get to that level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, we can provide you with detail as to how much of that goes out in special payments, which would be the actual payments. And, in fact, the $115 is basically the part that is special payments and some other contracted services. The staffing piece and the administration piece is part of the program support and central administration budget. So we'd have to break that out separately, but we can get that level of detail. Well,
to follow up on that, then, I mean, to really understand where we're going to be with that, we would have to have somewhat of a pro forma, a look forward at the age of the children in those families to know what it looks like going forward. See what I'm saying? I mean, in order to tell what it's going to look like, you know, you could take a snapshot and say, here's what it's going to look like this biennium, but unless we know what that group looks like, we can't follow that forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, the budget is built on a forecast, and that forecast is based on current caseloads and then expectations for growth. And so, again, when we get into the budget detail, we can talk exactly about how that forecast looks for 2005-07. And, in fact, as I think we've mentioned before, many of the numbers, the budget numbers that are in the governor's budget right now might change. It could be a little more, it could be a little less, depending on that forecast. But we'll talk about that a few months out.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
One last question. It's probably here somewhere. I just can't find it. How many children do we have that are being supported? They're in adoption and are being supported by these payments. What's the number?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, very good question. Could we go to that third adoption slide? Not that one, the next one. There you go.
Do we have that?
I believe those were given to you.
This was in the separate handout that we received on Monday. The cover shows Ways and Means presentation.
It's right behind the blue tab, which is behind the yellow tab, Children, Adults, and Families. You see kind of a PowerPoint? No.
Well, it's okay.
You don't have it in the same place.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I'd like to point out what it is that you're looking at. If you look at the 2004 number, that 9,200 61 number. That is not the number of children receiving an adoption subsidy check. That's the number of children who are receiving one or more post-adoption services. Of those children, about 85 to 8,600, remember we open up about 75 new ones a month, about 8,500 are receiving a subsidy check. In addition, there are 700 more children. That includes children who received only a medical card, but no subsidy check. And it's those children for whom we have an agreement only, and that means the family has declined a subsidy, the family has declined a medical card, but because of the way in which the Social Security law is written, unless we make an agreement with the family before the adoption is finalized, the child will forever be excluded from receiving adoption assistance benefits. So that it's like an insurance policy, that should the child's conditions that brought him into care change in the future, or the family situation change in the future, and they would require some kind of assistance, including medical assistance, they can come back and apply for that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson.
What percentage, does the federal government reimburse the state at all for any of the, what is subsidized to these that have been adopted?
Chair Richardson, Senator Anderson, yes, absolutely. It's the eligibility of children is based on the 4E eligibility, so that is the condition of the family or what the family's eligibility was, the child's eligibility at the time of the family from whom the child was removed initially. We worked very hard to establish that 4E eligibility because then for those children, there is a federal match on the money. I believe the match is about 62%, about 60%. So 60 cents on the dollar, federal 40, state money, general fund money. That is for about 78% of the children are 4E eligible. About then 20 to 25% are not 4E eligible and are general fund only.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quick question. Does that help terminate when the child is 18 or 21, or is there college assistance, or what? How does it end?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanson, very good question. In Oregon, adoption assistance terminates at the age of 18. Other states extend that to the age of 21. Oregon does not.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. Gosh, I think we're fast-forwarding to 1997. There were several things that happened in 1997 that really changed the landscape in terms of the number of children moving toward adoption and the timeliness of those adoptions. First of all, Oregon passed the Senate Bill 689, the Best Interest of the Child legislation, in part to address this problem of children spending too much time in foster care and not getting to permanency. Also that year, there was an interim legislative task force that met through 1998. That task force and an LFO study Sheila's was involved in that occurred in 1998 as well, made about 110 recommendations of adoption reforms that we needed to make to both move more children toward adoption and to do it faster. We implemented about 95% of those recommendations by 2001. In 1997, that was the passage of the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act. It created new standards for termination of parental rights. It created timelines that states needed to meet. And it really revolutionized how we look at adoption. In Oregon, what's changed for many years preceding that, about 12 to 14% of children who came into care and remained in care for more than 6 months ended up being moving on toward adoption. As you saw from the chart that Kevin showed you, that number is, or that percentage is now well over 20% of the children who come into care don't exit to adoption rather than to another place. Oregon, in 1999, the Oregon legislature brought all of ASPA into, or brought Oregon statute into conformance with the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act through Senate Bill 48 in 1999. I'm sorry, Adoption and Safe Families Act is ASPA.
Got it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vasquez.
That 20% that does not get any subsidy from the federal government, what type of children, what type of requirements does the state have that they would, what reasons are there that we would then subsidize that 20%, I guess is the question.
Chair Richardson, Senator Moniz Anderson, our state, our Oregon adoption assistance rules, our administrative rules, mirror the federal rules. So we don't make a differentiation about a child's eligibility for adoption assistance based on whether or not they are eligible for the federal participation. So regardless of whether or not a child is 4E eligible, based on the child's age, race, membership in a sibling group, or other special condition, that's what makes the child eligible.
I guess I want to know, this, we, the state of Oregon, decided that that 20% needed to be covered for a certain reason. Because I'm trying to...
Chair Richardson. Justification,
yeah,
for doing it when their means test would be above a 4E.
Chair Richardson, if I may, and Senator Moniz Anderson, the way 4E eligibility is determined is based on the family from which the child was removed. So the further you get away from that eligibility standard, the less it really matters to the special needs child or the child who's 14 and needs an adoptive home. So it's a bit of an archaic look back to see in 1996, would this family have been 4E eligible? It was a disconnect whenever welfare reform was put in place. And there is some concern in Congress about how that is an artificial divider between children who might qualify for 4E and children who do not, given that the standard is so old.
So the answer is that the child may have come from a family that was not 4E qualified but could be adopted by a very poor family that couldn't afford...
Chair Richardson, that's exactly the premise, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair Richardson, let's continue on page 19. As I stated earlier, since 1990...
Page 19...
19 behind the blue tab.
Okay.
Okay, we're good.
We're back to PowerPoint slide.
Okay. Since 1990, the number of children in state custody freed for adoption has grown from 500 to around 900. In past sessions, this committee has been interested in how those children are freed, so we've offered that to you here. Between 20 and 25% of children are voluntarily released by all of their parents, and sometimes a child may have more than two parents. And that is not a parent walking into our office and saying, I want to give you my child. That's after the children have come into our custody, and the parents decide that they will help us to plan an adoption of the child once it becomes clear that that child will not be returning to them. 40 to 45% of children are freed. We go into court and litigate a termination of parental rights. So those are actual trials that we go through. And then the remaining 30 to 40% of children are freed through a combination. One parent may voluntarily release while we do a court termination on another parent. During the two-year period ending September 30th, 2004, we completed, and when I say we, it is DHS and the Oregon private adoption agencies who participate with us, completed adoption studies for over 1,600 families for the adoption of children. And these include relative adoption studies, foster parent adoption studies, and what we call general applicant studies, families that we go out and recruit who are not interested in providing foster care but do want to adopt children. Most of the children, as we've said before, the overwhelming majority have one or more condition. Many of them are drug affected, alcohol affected, either before or after birth, and have a variety of physical, mental, or emotional conditions, either as a result of the abuse or because of a condition in the home.
I might mention to you that I don't know who does this brochure that comes out that shows pictures of children, special needs children, and then tells all about them. Is that a department thing, or is that privately done?
Chair Richardson, that's a service that we purchased from the Boys and Girls Aid Society of Oregon. That's one of our biggest partners in achieving adoption in Oregon. They operate the Special Needs Adoption Coalition. You're referring to Family Matters?
Yes.
Is what it is. It's comes out 10 times a year, provides a lot of adoption information, and features many of our children who are waiting for adoption.
If you haven't seen that, I mean, we have 9 children, right? So we had 8 girls in the home after we adopted, and then we'd get that, and I'd go home and say, now look, Kathy, look at this. You know, enough is enough. I mean, you know, it's very touching to read the stories of these children and to see the tragedy, you know, that they have gone through and the needs that they have. And, of course, you have to be realistic about, you know, it's not, if you adopt those children, you've changed your life because the time is so intensive in trying to make up for what they've gone through. But one thing that I think citizens need to have more contact with is a knowledge of the availability of these children, and I don't know how widely they get circulated. I mean, it's going to us because we were an adoptive family, but that is the kind of thing that a little extra funds to send to churches to disseminate, and to you know, other organizations or groups where there are people who have who might consider a higher need to spend their time, would certainly be well spent. And so anyway, I just mentioned that's a very powerful tool.
Chair Richardson, thank you for commenting about that. And I'd also like to thank you for being such a positive role model for your fellow legislators in adopting a special needs child from our system. Thank you. I want to talk for just a moment about disruption. Disruption is the interruption of an adoptive placement between the time we say we place the child into a family for the purposes of adoption and the time that the adoption is finalized. In the past, we've had discussions here about, oh gosh, is this our failure rate? It's not a failure rate at all. About 7%, between 6 and 7% per year of the children that we place in an adoptive home disrupt from that home before the adoption is finalized. While that's not an altogether good thing, what it means is that the family realized that this child has more needs than they're able to handle, or the child has developed new behaviors or conditions that we weren't aware of and the family wasn't aware of. It is, and those children come back into the system. Some of them have to go to residential treatment before they're replaced, but we have a very high success rate in replacing them the second time into a family that is able to meet their needs. In Oregon, after an adoption finalizes, that's as if the child had been born to the family. So it's much better if that placement is going to be interrupted, that it happened before the finalization, because it's very difficult to undo that adoption once it occurs. Let's go to page 20. And I think, I guess I talked about adoption support already. What I did not comment on is in 1999, we opened the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center. This was in large part due to the efforts of Representative, then Representative Cruz, now Senator Cruz, and Representative Jensen from Pendleton, who were very concerned about what we were doing to support families post-adoptively, not just with money, but also with the kinds of information referral services, training, ongoing education, and peer support. So we established that in 1999. So the number that you're seeing here includes those families who also receive services free of charge from the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center. And then finally, I want to comment about guardianship. In 2000, we began an assisted guardianship program through our federal 4E waiver. Since that time, we have moved just under 400 children from temporary foster care to guardianship. With most of those are with relatives, some of them are with their foster parents, and we are subsidizing those just like we subsidize some adoptions as well. Let's go to performance measures now. And if we could go back to the key performance measure, there we go. There is one key performance measure, DHS key performance measure associated with adoption, and that is the median number of months from date of latest removal from home to the finalized adoption. As you can see, we've had a decline in the median number of months to adoption, and that's a good thing. And we have met or exceeded the targets that were set and are continuing to do that. I know this committee is real interested in how we compare nationally. We did not put on the chart that we sent over to you, the national comparisons, for one very simple reason. We didn't want to confuse you. The feds, the information that the federal government provides to us is in mean months rather than in median months. And we have charted that. And I just want to talk about that for a minute. Oregon has exceeded since 1999 the federal mean time, meaning we're better than the national average in the time from removal to finalization at one time as much as 4.5 months, and now we're about 2 months better than the national average. From time of termination of parental rights to finalization, we're just about right on the money nationally. We're within a fraction of a month of the national average time that it takes to do that. Any questions about the key performance measure? Then let's move and finish up in the section behind the appendices, white appendices, page 15. And the title of that page is Adoptions. As I stated before, we have very good participation by the private sector in accomplishing adoptions. We have 11 licensed adoption agencies in Oregon who comprise the Special Needs Adoption Coalition, and they study and bring forward families, and we place children into them. The Boys and Girls Aid Society acts as the hub of that Special Needs Adoption Coalition and then also provides a training and does a lot of our recruitment for us. The Northwest Adoption Exchange, through a contract with them, a very long-standing contract with them, provides nationwide recruitment both through their website and also through the Adopt US Kids website. And then we have the participation of more than 50 out-of-state private adoption agencies who also bring us families for the placement of children. And those are normally our older children, our very large sibling groups. Last year we placed two sibling groups of six children each with families that live out of state. Of the children,
I'd like to ask a question. Are those with related, I mean, some type of kin, or are those completely unrelated families and the children are just adopted by families somewhere else?
Chair Richardson, about half of the children who go out of Oregon are adopted by relatives, and about half of them are adopted by families that whose adoption studies have been completed by private or public adoption agencies in other states but have no relationship with the child.
And why is there a preference for keeping a child in Oregon if it's an Oregon child?
Chair Richardson, when we begin recruitment for children to find adoptive families, we begin kind of concurrently. We develop what's called a waiting child bulletin, and that bulletin is immediately disseminated via intranet to all of our Oregon offices, all of our DHS offices, as well as to the private agencies in Oregon. At the same time, we are preparing to do regional and national recruitment efforts. Therefore, if we are unable to match the child or the sibling group with an Oregon family, we are ready to match that child with an out-of-state family.
Is there a financial subsidy from somewhere that brings in additional money to Oregon if a child is adopted outside of Oregon?
Chair Richardson, no. No, there's no...
No federal extra money or anything like that?
No, there's no extra money.
Okay, who pays for transportation and those other costs and the additional costs of coordinating an adoption in another state?
Chair Richardson, that is part of our purchased adoption budget that Sheila will talk about later on, I believe.
Purchased adoption?
That's what we call purchased adoption. Whenever we use private agencies to help us with our work, we call that purchased adoption, or when we place children out of state.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Just going back to the adoption mean, average page, which will confuse us, not at this time, but when we have our second phase, if you could break that down a little bit, I'd appreciate it so we can get a better picture of what it really means for a child moving to the foster system. Like see, by ethnicity, by people of color, by children with special needs, can you give me a flavor by age, how long, you know, a certain age, you know, children are more difficult to place, and just give me kind of a more of a flavor of what really is going on than just a raw number.
Churches and Senator Bates, we're happy to provide that to you, and that it's, there are things that we look at all the time.
I imagine you do, and if you can give that to us later, it'd be fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's finish up then on page 15. As we talked before, about a third of children are adopted by relatives, about a third by non-related foster parents, and a third are families that we recruit. 77% of the children are adopted by Oregon families, and 23% last year went out of state, and that included about half of those were with relative families. 72% were adopted by families that we recruited that worked directly with us, 5% by those Oregon private agencies, and the remainder with out-of-state agencies. Even though we are prohibited by federal law to make a placement, to do race matching in placement, what our data shows is that well over 90% of our kids end up in a family where at least one of the parents is of the same race or ethnicity. About a quarter of our kids were age 9 or older at the time of the adoption finalization. And a very large number of our children are members of sibling groups, and we place a very high value on keeping siblings together based on a lot of long-term research showing that that really is a child's most important relationship through life is with the child's siblings. When we're unable to do that in about 5% of the cases, we make sure that we do everything possible so that children know where their siblings are to keep them in contact.
Okay.
We're done.
We're done. Final questions or comments? All right, thank you so much. We look forward to receiving the materials that you can put together for us. And if you wanted to put together the materials that were mentioned by Senator Bates at this time and present that to us, it would be it would be good to have us take a look at that as we consider the other data you're presenting.
We'd be glad to do that. Thank you.
And now we are prepared to move to the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services.
Good morning, Chairman Richardson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stephanie Parrish Taylor, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation. And I would draw your attention to page 20 behind the blue tab for our section of the presentation book. And I'll begin by talking briefly about giving you a historical perspective on our program. I would note that we are a relatively small program for our children, adults, and family. To give you some sense of perspective of that, our statewide FTE is 204, and I would compare that to CAF staff in Multnomah County, where they have nearly 850 staff. So we're a small program that works hard statewide. The thing I think is important for you to know about our legislation is that over the last 20 years or so, there's been an increasing focus of that legislation to serve individuals with the most severe disabilities. We've moved away from the notion about talking about feasibility to the presumption that those individuals with the most severe disabilities can, in fact, benefit from our services. And we are required to demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt that a person, in fact, cannot benefit from our services. More recently, the Act has called on us to presume eligible for our services all individuals who are recipients of SSI or SSDI benefits. And sheltered employment, work in workshops such as Goodwill or St. Vincent de Paul or Garten here in Salem are no longer countable employment outcomes for us. So you can see from this that there's been a marked shift to serving people with quite complex and challenging disabling conditions. We've also had federal standards and indicators established for the programs. There are a number of them that we must pass, and failure to do so would result in either a performance improvement plan or a reduction in funding. So there's been even more accountability placed on our program from the federal level. The other thing that we are coming against is the realities of the 21st century workforce. There are both challenges and opportunities that presents for us, and I'm optimistic that the worker shortages that unfortunately will plague many of our employers in this state will create enhanced employment opportunities for people with disabilities. At the federal level, our funding has remained relatively flat for the last couple of decades. We do get an annual consumer price index cost of living, but there's been no substantial influx of new dollars into the federal program while states struggle with the mandate to serve folks with severe disabilities and the substantial costs in things like technology and medical services that many of our consumers require. Unfortunately, the formula that the Rehabilitation Services Administration uses to allocate funds to the states takes into account states that have high earnings, of which Oregon is one, and so we get potentially less money than we might otherwise get because we've in the state done a good job of getting people to work at relatively decent wages. And the final thing that I would point out in terms of looking back and seeing the changes that the agency has confronted in the last few years is that a very important partner for us, the State Rehabilitation Council, has moved from an advisory role to that of a policy partner with us. And I am delighted to let you know that the State Rehab Council here in Oregon is seen as a national model and was invited to participate with the Rehabilitation Service Administration in developing training for other state rehab councils across the country. And I think it's something that we can be quite proud of.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
Thank you. Moving on to talk about our programs, we have basically four programs that we run through the office. That is our basic vocational rehabilitation program. The best way to think about that is it's the program that we run to get people with disabilities back to work. We have a youth transition program, a supported employment program, and independent living services. In terms of our basic rehab program, it is an eligibility program. It is simply not enough to have a medical condition to qualify for our services. That condition, in fact, has to be documented by a medical professional, and it has to result in an impediment to employment. My staff have to interview and work with a person to establish how generally two or three health conditions get in the way of them either maintaining work or entering the workforce. And they need to require services of a substantial nature to address those impediments. Once that person is found eligible, the federal law requires that we meet all of their needs. And one of the challenges for us is that they've in fact created an entitlement program for us without entitlement funding. As I noted earlier, our funding has remained flat, and we receive no increase at the federal level if, in fact, we serve more individuals. In the presentation, there were questions about residency, and so I thought that I would speak to that quite briefly.
Okay, before you do, would you mind just giving us an idea of how the Staley money connects or interferes or interacts with your program?
I could do that now, or I could do it in a minute when I get to the supported employment program. Would that be all right? There is nothing within the federal law that speaks to residency requirements. For some of our states, it is often easier to go to a neighboring state than to go to the closest office in your own state. So the feds wanted to take that into account when they looked at the issue of residency. We, however, were finding, because our neighbor to the north, Washington State, is in an order of selection, they have approximately 18,000 people on their wait list, that Washingtonians in the southern part of their state were coming across the river seeking services. So we did go in and we tweaked the state statute to make that substantially more difficult for them to do. For us, you have to be in the state with the intent to work in the state to receive services.
Okay. I want to just clarify that, and also for Gary Weeks, who I've had some contact with. I've done some research and have received actual OARs that indicate that there is no residency requirement for any, as far as length of time, for any program where there's federal money involved. that it's enough if a person comes to the state of Oregon and indicates that their intention is to remain a resident, which means that you could actually go into a motel and make the decision that you want to remain here as a resident, and that then benefits are going to be provided. There had been some discussion as to whether or not there was a six-month waiting period, and there is no such waiting period.
Well, let me clarify. There is no duration of residency specified in our act, in our rules.
That's my understanding, and that applies to, my understanding is, all programs that have federal funds.
Once a person comes into our basic rehab program, we spend time working with them to identify an appropriate vocational goal. We develop an individualized employment plan, and we go about putting that plan into play. We are a heavily individualized program. We can have people with the same disability, the same vocational goal, but potentially wind up with two different plans given what else is going on with that individual. Our act places a lot of emphasis on consumer choice in the process and empowerment. So there's a fair amount of engagement of our consumers in developing those plans. If you would like additional information about those individuals who are on our caseload, I would refer you to the appendix and to page 26. And there you can look through and see a variety of detail that we've offered about that. Mm-hmm. Moving on to the Youth Transition Program, this is a program I think we are particularly proud of. It's done in partnership with the Oregon Department of Education, the University of Oregon, and local school districts statewide. In 2003-2005, we had 36 local locations affecting 113 high schools and serving 1,300 youth. 92% of youth transition students served either owned a standard diploma, that was 50%, or they earned another type of recognized completion document, typically a GED or an adult basic education certificate, and that accounted for 42%. The reason that this matters is that successful high school completion is closely linked to positive adult outcomes. We believe that this is an effective strategy to break that cycle of very high unemployment rates that you see in adults with disabilities. We've been able to track these students out, and they continue to be employed or engaged in education, which continue to be good predictors that they will do well in the future. To answer your question about STALEY, the individuals served under the STALEY agreement are those individuals who have very significant level of disability. We recognize that there are people with very significant levels of disability that if they had ongoing support once our time-limited services ended, that they could continue to be employed. And the challenge has always been to find the funding for that ongoing support. And the dollars in the STALEY settlement allow many of those individuals to purchase that ongoing support that allows them to continue to be employed. We have served 1,100 individuals who are covered by the STALEY settlement, and we have gotten a number of those folks into employment. And it's exciting to see folks that many would consider as unemployable, in fact, be able to go out, work in community settings with people without disabilities, and earn at least minimum wage. And those are the criteria for supported employment. People cannot be in sheltered employment. They can't be doing piecework. And they can't spend their days surrounded by other people with disabilities. And it's been a very positive thing to see those folks make those kinds of transitions. We have also been involved with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services around their efforts to implement Senate Bill 267, which calls for them to use increasing amounts of state dollars to support evidence-based practice and local community mental health programs. One of those practices is individualized placement and support. It is a variation of supported employment for those individuals with the most significant psychiatric disabilities. And we're currently involved in 5 sites around the state doing some piloting. We're doing some work with the office around figuring out how to pay for the ongoing supports that those individuals would need. And I'm also pleased to note that both the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services and the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services received jointly from Dartmouth College Johnson & Johnson an award for our efforts in this area. We, in fact, were recipients of some of their money to help us do this work. Finally, it is the independent living program that I'd like to focus on. We actually pass the federal dollars that come to us for this program through to the State Independent Living Council, who coordinates with 10 centers around the states who work with individuals around a number of important issues. They help people become more independent in their own communities. They do a lot of the very challenging work of helping people come to grips with the reality that they have a disabling condition. For many folks who've been institutionalized, it helps them regain their sense of empowerment. They've been an important partner to us and doing the work that we do. They've served 16,000 people over this biennium. They've written over 4,000 long-term plans, and they've assisted 136 people relocate from nursing homes or other institutional settings.
That's great.
In terms of who it is that we serve anyone who's legal to work in the state, and that generally means anybody who's 16 years or older. Increasingly, we are serving a number of seniors who find that they are unable to live on their Social Security benefits. And we believe that this will be an emerging population for us as older workers continue, for whatever reason, to remain in the workforce. And it's a different set of disabilities that we're used to seeing, and we're feeling some need to gear up to address that. I talked a bit about the severity of disability. To give you some understanding on that, when we start looking at severity or thinking about severity, we typically are looking at a combination of the number of impediments that a person would have, those things that get in the way of them going to work, the number of services that they might need to address those impediments, and how long those services would last. So the more impediments, the more services, and the greater length of time typically equates to a greater level of severity.
Are there any impediments that, I mean, by definition, would not normally be like a physical impediment? In other words, we got a list of, you know, from adoptive services that include people of color and other things that are not normally related to health conditions but qualify for subsidies. And so I'm just wondering what is included in the categorization of as an impediment.
An impediment, let me clarify this a bit. What we would get is a health diagnosis. Say we would take the diagnosis of diabetes. What we need to say is, are there impediments, are there problems raised by this diagnosis of diabetes that would prevent someone from working? Say they were a long-haul truck driver, and they were prone to poor management of their diabetes, so they might not be as clear-headed. Well, that's a problem. If you're a long-haul truck driver, we would hope that they're pretty clear-headed and alert. So that presents an impediment.
I'm on a diabetic pump myself,
right.
And so if things get out of hand, understand, it's
right.
Probably part of my impediment.
Right. The need to eat regular meals. And if you're in a job, say you're working in an emergency room, and you need to meet what's coming in the door, you can't very well say, excuse me, it's time for my snack, and someone's arresting. I mean, you have to be available and alert to work. So those are the kinds of things that we look at. Some of the impediments rise to a level that they require services from us. Some of them don't. And in those cases, we would not find that person eligible for services. We serve all medical conditions with the exception of blindness, and those individuals are served by our sister agency, the Oregon Commission for the Blind.
How about mental?
Yes. A significant part of our caseload, we find or individuals who experience as a primary or a secondary disability a psychiatric illness. And I think I misdirected you earlier when I was talking about the caseload. I think we really would want to look in our appendix on page 21. And you can see at the bottom of page 21 on the left-hand side, we're giving you a breakout of our primary disabilities. So we have looked historically at our caseloads, and we've seen a shift where we are seeing increasing numbers of individuals who have psychiatric disabilities as well as substance abuse issues. And unfortunately, in presenting some of this information historically, the feds changed how they did their disability coding, and so it's very hard for us to give you a clean historical trend line because of the problems with the data.
Okay, thank you.
I would add that somewhere between 30% and 40% of our statewide caseload is made up of individuals who are recipients of SSI or SSDI.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, these books are a little tough, I got to tell you. Going from tab to tab to find all of this. So I don't mean to be confusing here, but under the green tab portion on some of the graph materials, page 21 of that, the percentage of consumers with a goal of employment who are employed.
Okay.
And so I have a question there. Well, I have several here, so give me some follow-up just for a moment. But your stated mission is to help people gain employment and independence.
Mm-hmm.
So what percent of the people you're serving have a goal of being employed?
Let me back up and see if I can help you with that. The way that that key performance measure is worded is there would be different ways to get to an outcome number around employment. And for those who have a goal of employment, it is those individuals who have gotten through our process to the point that they have developed an employment goal. So we're using that as our base. So those are the people with a goal of employment who become employed, and so that's how we get the formula that we use to get to that number. People who come in for services, all of them come in with the intent of going to work. And talking with them, they often realize that their disability is at a place that this may not be the best timing. They may be at a place that when you look at their benefits, that they won't be able to replace their health care, which is critical to many of our people. And as much as they might want to go to work, they can't lose that health care coverage. And so they will decide not to go to work. Many of our people have significant disabilities that worsen over time, and they may come in fairly good shape and unfortunately become worse and will have to stop services with us because of health problems. You know, life happens for people. There may be a need to move or take care of a family member, and they drop out of the process. So for purposes of this key performance measure, we are using as our base those individuals who have actually gotten through the plan, who have done considerable work with us to get to that point.
Can I follow up? I want to make sure so that I'm understanding this, because on page 20, there's the two graphs there. One shows that we're serving 18,000 consumers. And of that group, 26 or 700 found employment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's, you know, 14-15% of the mm-hmm. total group that came in the door, 14 or 15% found employment. Where did the 61% group that got employed, what part of the pie are they?
Okay. Of the 18,000 people who are on our caseload, they're at various points in the process. They may be in the eligibility process. The federal law requires that within 60 days that we make an eligibility decision. So we're going to pull some people off of that 1,800, and we could get you the data to let you know a point in time how that breaks out. We have people that once found eligible, we are doing vocational counseling with them to help them establish a vocational goal. That's going to pull some additional folks out of that 18,000. Then we will get to those folks who are actually in plan. And we get to the 65% as a percentage of those people who successfully complete those plans. So we've narrowed the pool that we're using as the base.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates. Just a couple quick questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First up, the people you're dealing with, for the most part, in my experience, are pretty severely disabled. This is not someone who has a sore back. These people have serious problems. And I assume this is a flow-through program. Of the 18,000 clients, you're moving people through on a continuing basis. Most of them don't stay with you for a long period of time. They either get placed, or they realize they can't be placed, or they can't work in the workforce. So I'm assuming the flow-through that I've seen before is continuing. Is that true?
Chairman Richardson, Senator Bates, yes, that's accurate. Okay.
How big a wait list do you have right now?
Chairman Richardson, Senator Bates, we currently do not have a wait list.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. You gave us one graph here, which I'm not trying to have people look up or go crazy finding things. But the graph basically says, you're spending about $1,000 per year per client, which from my point of view is pretty doggone good. Your number of FTEs per case workers about 1 to 90. And what intrigued me about these figures, you compared yourself to other states, and you have a caseload of about 18,000. Washington State has a caseload of about 17,000. Their population is roughly twice ours. It makes me worry about people coming in from Washington that you mentioned before coming into our state, because you guys are doing a great job, and it sounds like something's wrong in Washington State. They're on northern border here. I mean, how can their caseload be the same as yours?
Well, their
population is twice as big. Are they doing figures differently? Are we seeing people coming across to utilize your services?
Chairman,
I read the chart wrong.
No, you're reading. Chairman Richardson, Senator Bates, the chart that Senator Bates is referring to is in the appendix on page 28 at the top of the page, and it provides regional comparisons to the other rehabilitation programs in Region 10. Washington General is currently in an order of selection. In addition to the roughly 18,000 people you see listed, they have approximately 18,000 people awaiting services. They're on a wait list. They've been found eligible. They've been prioritized based on their disability, and they're waiting. Washington, for a number of years, had failed to bring in their full federal allotment, and they got into trouble, in part, that they didn't have sufficient resources to support their program. They also had a cage management system that I believe made it difficult for them to track their expenditures. And because of that, they got into trouble because they were overspent and they were late in capturing that fact. And so they have been in an order of selection, I believe, for 3 years. And that's part of the difficulty.
Mr. Chair.
I'm not going to try to manage Washington State. I can't handle Oregon, okay? That's their problem. But I want to know if we've got a problem because of that. Are we seeing an influx of people into our state as a result of Washington State's inability to handle their situation?
We have seen that, and in part that motivated us to revisit residency within our regs, and we've tweaked that to eliminate those folks coming from a state in an order of selection to seek our services.
The tweaking that you indicated was very minor in that basically they can't just commute, right? I mean, they have to actually move over and say that they have a termination to be a permanent resident, and this can only get worse because the terminator's at work to the south of us, and there could be an influx from the south as well. So the question is going to be, how do we prepare for that, and are you anticipating a substantial increase in caseload in the next 2 to 4 years?
I would anticipate an increase in caseload. I don't believe that a significant part of that will be from Washington State.
How about California?
We've not experiencing that problem from California. I know that they've been in an order of selection for a number of years, so I think that would have surfaced, you know, quite some time ago if that was going to be a reality from California.
Okay.
Okay. One thing it points out, Mr. Chair, you guys are doing a good job.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. You're doing a good job, and it looks like Idaho is too. So that's what it sounds to me like. Is in Washington and maybe California, but Washington, people just have to wait and wait and wait. They're not productive, and they're sitting there in Seattle wondering what's going on. Well, you guys get the job done.
Chairman Richardson, Senator Bates, thank you very much.
Please continue. Do you want to look at performance measures?
Okay, We've talked a bit about the performance measures. I would add that we have updated data for 2003 and 2004. In 2003, the data point should be 60, and in 2004, it is 56.5. I'm pleased to note that as we look at October 2004 through December 2004, we were at 62.5% as compared to 57.0% for the same period in 2003. We expect this improvement in outcomes to continue and should be trending upward in the year to come. I would refer you to page 24 in our appendix. On pages 24-25, we have the federal standards and indicators that I referenced earlier in my presentation. Bear with me, this is a little complicated in how this works. To meet federal expectations, we must pass indicator 2.1, we must pass four of indicators 1.1 through 1.6, and we have to pass two of indicators 1.3 to 1.5.
There won't be a quiz on this one.
No.
Great. Okay.
And we've displayed both the federal standard as well as the performance of Washington, Alaska, and Idaho for 2001, 2002, as well as 2002 and 2003.
As I scan through, it looks like that we are at or better in each of the categories. Is there any category that Oregon is behind and that we ought to look at?
Actually, on indicator 1.1, and this would be tied to the key performance indicator because our percentage of employment outcomes went down, the raw number also went down. And for some reason, when the RSA sent out this information, they provided it as an aggregate for the region, and so it's not included because it didn't seem to be helpful. I would draw your attention to indicator 1.4, where the federal standard is 62.4 and we are at 95.7. This speaks to the number of folks with severe or most severe rating of disability that we are serving. And I think that's a very positive indicator for us that we're doing a good job serving people with very significant level of disability.
I see Washington's doing really well, and it probably helps if you put a cap.
Well, because Chairman Richardson, because they are in the order of selection, they are required by law to serve the most severe first.
Right. Okay. Well, congratulations. You're doing a good job.
Thank you.
Is there anything further that you'd like to say?
Thank you.
Any questions, comments? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ramona.
Yes, Chair Richardson, would you like to begin with the discussion around the field part of CAF, or are you...
No, I think we'll wait till tomorrow.
Okay, that would be fine with us.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate all who participated today and the good information you've given us. And we look forward to those follow-ups, and we are now adjourned. Okay.